Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
As Marshal of the University, it's my pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the Regents, administration, faculty, and students to the dedication of the Elmer E. Rasmussen Library. We apologize for the short delay, and there's one small change on the early in the program. William Howe, who was to give one of the responses, is out fighting a fire this morning. He's a member of our fire department. So Dennis Dooley, who is the president-elect and for 70-71, president of the Associated Students, will take his place. Other than that, the program will proceed as according to the program without interruption from me. And the invocation now will be given by the Reverend David W. Croft.
Shall we stand? Let us pray. Almighty God, we invoke thy presence with us this day as we realize thou art the author of all knowledge. We would petition thee to make us aware of what is before us. We will have hearts that are open. We'll have minds that are sharp. That in all of our creativity we may strive to serve man in thy created order. We pray it in thy holy name. Amen.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. As President of the Board of Regents, and on behalf of the Board of Regents, it is a pleasure for me to turn this building over, completed, to the faculty and students of this university, which they've been looking long forward to using. Some of you may not realize it, but this is the fourth time that there has been a location for a library on this university campus. Back in 1922, back up until 1935, the original library resided in the old main building, which is now long gone. From 1935 till 1960, the library was up above the old gymnasium, which is now being used as the museum. From 1960 up until the present day, the library was in the one wing of the Bunnell building. During this span of years, as you can see from your brochure that you have, the volumes have increased from a very small number of 2,300 up to a figure of pretty near 220,000 volumes. And we have never had enough space to house the library or to provide an adequate library for this university up until now. And it is not going to be many years before it will be necessary to add an addition to this library, which has already been planned in the original concept of the building. So again, it's a pleasure for me to turn this building over for the use of the students and the faculty, and I hope they do enjoy it and make good use of it. Thank you.
Very special honor
be to be invited to accept this building on behalf of the faculty, the researchers, and the library staff. And I assure you it's an honor which I do not take lightly. Thomas Carlyle once remarked that the true university of these days is a collection of books. He was, I think, referring to the library, which was in his day a collection of books. We reaffirm his statement today, but in the sophistication born of our modern technology, we include non-book resources as well. Today, we assert that the library is the heart of the university, and we mean library in its broadest sense. It has been said so often that it has become a cliche, yet its repetition does really not detract from its very basic truth. The library is the heart of the university. The Polar Star of November 1st, 1957 contained an article by John Mailer, who was then the university librarian, and it occurred to me that it might be pertinent to refer to it here. Mr. Mailer wrote, "The library accessioned its first book, Ruddle's Alaska, Its Meaning to the World, on September 28, 1922. From the opening of the then Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines until 1935, the library was housed in various rooms in the main building. The move to its present quarters over the gymnasium was made in 1936. Grace C. Clark is listed as instructor of physical education and librarian in the catalog for 1926-27. This is the first listing in the catalog of a librarian. Prior to this time, Mrs. Patty, who before her marriage was on the staff of Whitman College, did the cataloging and in general supervised the library." Mr. Mailer goes on to say, talking about the library, which at that time was over the gymnasium, he says, "Naturally, being placed over a gym is not the most ideal place for a library. But a move had to be made, and there was no place else to go. There were some improvements, if they can be called that," he goes on, "when the rifle range was moved to Maine and when the university engineer fixed the basketball backstops so they wouldn't vibrate." And then he says, which brings us to the point where soon, sometime in 1959, the library will again move. The move this time will be to plush new quarters in the multi-purpose building, a move which everyone is looking forward to with pleasure and anticipation. The new library of the article is what we now refer to as the old library. Now I should like to tell you briefly what this new library means to us. It is roughly 7 or 8 times larger in floor area than our old library. For the students, faculties, and researchers, it means a design capacity for more than 400,000 volumes. And I want to point out that we already have, as Mr. O'Neill has pointed out, more than 240,000 selected volumes freely available on OpenStax at this moment. It also means current access to more than 300,000 units of microfilm, microfilm, microfiche, microcards. It means access to 3,000 periodical subscriptions in a very broad range of subjects. It means a map collection, a phonograph record collection of both music and the spoken word, a treasure collection of rare books, an extensive collection of government documents, a manuscript collection of primary source materials that is achieving a position of national renown. And what is the setting of these resources? It's a new 5-level library facility which has been designed to incorporate or accommodate foreseeable advances in technology and automation. comfortable, fully carpeted, tastefully designed setting that will seat at one time one quarter of the expected enrollment on this campus in 1975. 90% of our seating is at individual study carrels. The library includes lockable study carrels, faculty research studies, seminar rooms, typing rooms, a microform room equipped with microform readers and printers, a reserved reading room, an audio room where phonograph records may be played, and many, many more facilities that have never been available on this campus. If you haven't already seen them, I hope that you will take the opportunity to do so this afternoon. Tour guides will be available to assist you. I should like to talk just for a moment about three responsibilities. The first is responsibility for providing for the university the physical facility, the building. That responsibility has certainly been met, and met well, by the people of Alaska who have made this building possible. The second responsibility is to make optimum use of the facility, and that responsibility must be met by the people for whom the facility was provided. At our recent and very successful environmental teach-in, or Earth Day, I heard someone use the motto, love it or lose it. Perhaps we can paraphrase that motto and apply it to the library as use it or lose it. You know, regardless of the librarian's basic love for books, if all the books were gone from the shelves, I think the library staff would be delighted if they were being properly used. Well, even if we have some books left on our shelves, I can assure you that the use of the library has increased dramatically since we have moved into the building. The second responsibility, then, is being met. Of that, I have no doubt. Incidentally, it's probably an apocryphal story, but it was somewhat unreliably reported to me that when the books were being transferred from the old library to our new library, one of the volunteers allegedly remarked, excuse me, why are we moving these books? You'd think when we get a new library, we'd at least get new books. That leads me to the third responsibility, and it is a continuing one. When Andrew Cuff was librarian at Harvard and was asked for an appropriate slogan to be carved over the door of their new library at that time, he suggested inscribing the following: this is not the library. You'll find that inside. Well, I think he had a good point. Our continuing task is clear. We must concentrate now on building not merely an adequate collection to support the academic program which we offer here, and not merely a good collection. We must build a collection of eminence and excellence, a collection that is worthy of this facility, of this university, and of the people of our great state of Alaska. We will not be content to be only a storehouse of knowledge either. We will not be content with having a hush-hush library, and I'm sure you know the type to which I refer. Benjamin Disraeli, in his memoir of Isaac Disraeli, said, a book may be as great as a battle, and we intend for this library to be a battleground in that sense. That sense only, God willing. We welcome the controversial, but we will not be partisan. In keeping with our commitment to intellectual freedom, we continue to strive to build a balanced collection with information available on all points of view. When men landed on the moon's Sea of Tranquility, they must have been immediately envied by many people. governors, college presidents, librarians as well. For tranquility, as defined in the dictionary, is a state of serene calmness, free from agitation, free from disturbance or turmoil. But the Moonwalkers found one other important characteristic of tranquility that the dictionary doesn't mention: lifelessness. We don't want a lifeless library. We intend to meet this third responsibility with a dynamic library, including a dynamic collection and a dynamic level of service. Finally, I should like to remark about the appropriateness of naming this library the Elmer E. Rasmussen Library of the University of Alaska, to honor a man whose special interest in books and libraries is well known to all Alaskans. His beneficence is already evident in this library, although few know of it. Some materials contained in our library today are here only because of the quiet personal support of Mr. Rasmussen. It is with great humility that I extend to all of you here and to the many others who also helped make this building possible, but who are unable to be here today, to those who will contribute to the enrichment and development of this library in the future, a very sincere thank you on behalf of the faculty and the staff for making our dream, which we see translated into this library building that we are privileged to dedicate today, come true.
Days ago, President Wood received a telephone call indicating that our scheduled speaker, Dr. Earl McGrath, was ill and would not be able to join us. We are especially indebted, therefore, that our eminent speaker today has joined us on such short notice. Many ways today we have heard that the library is the common bond throughout academia. It is indeed the center of life, place of learning anywhere in the world. It seems fitting, therefore, that our speaker this afternoon is an international scholar and an authority on the Soviet North. Born in Limpsfield, Surrey, England, he completed his BA in Modern Languages, his MA, and his PhD at Cambridge University. His formal university education was interrupted by 6 years of military duty as an officer in the Intelligence Corps Field Security and a parachutist in the 1st Airborne Division. He served in North Africa, Italy, Holland, Norway, Germany, and was wounded in the Battle of Arnhem. His academic career includes a research fellowship in Russian at the Scott Polar Research Institute, 1949-51, and a consultantship for the Royal Naval Scientific Service, 1951-53. He also served as a senior treasury studentship under the Scarborough Scheme from 1949-51. From 1956 to present, he has been director of the research at the Cambridge University. He is also a fellow of Clare Hall from 1964 to present and a tutor. Currently holds the National Science Foundation Senior Foreign Science Fellowship at the University of Alaska. In pursuing his teaching, his writing, and his scholarship, he has made numerous visits to the northern latitudes, Scandinavia, including Arctic Norway, Sweden, Finland, to Russia numerous times, including Siberia, to the United States, including Alaska, as early as 1954, Canada, including the Northwest Territories, and also he's made a voyage to the Northwest Passage. He's the author of numerous books, including The Northern Sea Route, Russians in the Arctic, Sea Ice North of the USSR, and the Russian Settlement in the North. In addition, he has published more than 60 articles and papers with emphasis on the Soviet North and its development in scholarly journals throughout the world. Our speaker's topic today is a library for the North. It's very great privilege to introduce to you Dr. Terrence Edward Armstrong.
I am indeed very greatly honored to be asked to speak on this occasion. If I have any qualification to do so, it's simply as a user of this library and of other libraries. And I'm impressed that you judge it appropriate for one such to have the opportunity to have his say. And I find it extraordinarily generous that you choose as that one an overseas visitor. A library is the repository of human knowledge. And a good one is the most precious artifact of civilization. Not only does it provide the link of the thought and actions of our diverse human predecessors on this planet, but progress, scientific, cultural, scholarly, technological, can only be achieved by building on earlier attainments. A library must, therefore, be at the center of any institution of higher learning. There can be no doubt that your library here has made an excellent start. When I was on this campus in 1954, I used the library then. It was already, with its Skinner collection, a serviceable one. But the progress made in the intervening 16 years is striking indeed. And I don't refer only to this fine building we're about to dedicate. I'm especially pleased to see that rapid growth has not led you to abandon the principle of open stacks. On the simple issue of speed in getting your book, how pleasantly this contrasts with the great national collections. During your long wait in the British Museum reading, to reflect that Karl Marx and Lenin probably had to wait just as long. At the Bibliothèque Nationale, they eye you with suspicion which seems to increase as the hours pass on. At the Saltykov-Shchedrin Library in Leningrad, you can ruminate about the policewoman on the stairs who scrutinizes your credentials but not your possessions as you enter and leave. But there's something more important than speed. The whole system of requesting a book, and then perhaps getting it, depends on your knowing what book you want. There is another aspect of research, and I would not say that it's less important, in which the exciting new idea comes from reading the book that caught your eye when you were looking for the one you thought you wanted. The word browsing on overtones for this purposeful, if unpremeditated, process. Humans being frail, the open stack system generally attracts, alas, theft, or as I would prefer to think of it, unauthorized borrowing. Let me urge you not to let your distress at this affect your policy. The rare book section may have to be increased. Other preventives may have to be found. But do keep accessibility at a maximum. You're already paying close attention to the ways in which modern technology comes to the aid of the reader. You have all the necessary equipment to read microphotographic material. You'll soon have teletype connection with other libraries. New equipment will no doubt be developed, and you'll be keeping your eye on this. More and more publications are likely to have to be stored for space reasons in photomicrographic form. Few readers will welcome this. None who've at any time had to read on microfilm a book with a colored fold-out map at the end. But it's inevitable. Growth rate in libraries has been a matter of concern for some time. Of making many books there is no end, sighed the writer of Ecclesiastes. remember Sir Leonard Woolley, the archaeologist, when lecturing on his discovery at Ur of some of the earliest alphabetic material known, reported finding a tablet which complained that everybody was writing too much these days. For the moment, how good it is to see that rarest of all sights in a large library, empty shelves. More radical mechanization, in the sense of a fully automated information retrieval system, is not yet, happily, in sight for the general library. For a reader to be able to press a button and obtain all available information on a given subject would require the librarian to have organized an exceedingly complex subject arrangement. And even harder to achieve, it would require the reader to arrange his thoughts in precisely similar categories, and to know much more accurately than he usually does, poor muddled fool, what he wants. These considerations apply, of course, to any large library, such as a university library. But your library will not, I hope, be any large library. Its general educational function, it can and must continue to fulfill. But it should also be the American Library for the North. At this northernmost university in the New World, there will always be a special, perhaps a dominant, interest in the problems of the Arctic and subarctic. They cannot be studied effectively without knowledge of how they arose, of what other solutions have been tried. In other words, without the relevant literature. It's at the university, and not at the state capital or the big city, that the visitor will expect to find the best center of documentation. There's been talk of starting an interdisciplinary course in Northern Studies here, an idea I heartily commend. For this, the best library support is not so much desirable as essential. Happily, you have an admirable nucleus for such support in the Skinner Collection, and in your archives with their excellent facilities. It takes time and unremitting effort to build up these last, and I'm sure this effort is now being made. The archival material will no doubt be very largely Alaskan, but the books must continue to be circumpolar, and at least in certain respects, bipolar. There is much relevant experience in other parts of the world. Most of all, perhaps, across Bering Strait. To obtain the literature from these other regions is not at all easy. But this is where modern technology really makes all the difference. No longer need any book be a rare book, except for the bibliophile, and he's a special case. The small circle of northern libraries, there are about half a dozen in the world, will, I'm sure, be very happy to cooperate. I can certainly speak for my own in Cambridge. So, let me add my small voice to the great volume of good wishes and glowing hopes. This library is magnificently housed and staffed. You have a fine basic collection, which has improved dramatically in the last decade. You're operating on the enlightened principle of helping the reader rather than hoarding the books. You're aware of the ways in which improved technology can help. You are poised to become one of the major northern collections in the world, and that is the direction I hope you will decide to take.
Mrs. Rasmussen. That's Mrs. Armstrong. Mrs. Bartlett, Mrs. Miller, members of the Board of Regents, faculty, students, friends of the University of Alaska. As executive officer of the Board of Regents, and as president of the University of Alaska, I am honored beyond measure to dedicate this magnificent new library, the Library of the North, to Elmer E. Rasmussen, the most significant Alaskan of all. Elmer was born, as you know, in the Indian village of Yakutat, the territory of Alaska, and spent his life in a very successful career in this new state, 49th. Contributed more than, or almost a score of years, two decades of his exceedingly valuable time and his exceptional talents to the Board of Regents of a young and struggling institution of higher learning. And for a baker's dozen of those years, he was president of that board. Nine of those years he had put up with me. And that in itself is, I think, a mark of distinction for him. Almost the day that I came to Alaska, however, the idea of an adequate library facility for the university was dominant in the thinking. Members of the board. I'd like to spend but a moment here in pointing out that the accomplishment was not without its struggles. And there were some really giants in the effort to bring about this facility, which has been described by persons from other states who have had the opportunity to visit it recently, since we moved into it, as one of the best planned libraries, one of the best selected collections, although small, one of the best administered in terms of services provided by the talented staff of any library that I've ever known. Among these giants, were the vice presidents who assisted in the conception of the so-called user's study of what was needed. The first of these was Dr. George Adams, who was the first academic vice president, who is with us today, having come from Southern Illinois for the occasion. Mrs. Adams with him. Dr. Howard Cutler is now the International Education at the United Nations. Second, and who spent, I think, 4 years in the planning effort. And Mrs. Cutler is here today. They have come from New York City for the occasion. Dr. Earl Beistlin took over for a couple of years. And now, toward the end, we had the privilege of dynamic young academic vice president, Dr. Donald Theodorus. But in raising the money, which requires a special effort of its own, the Vice President for Research, Dr. Kenneth Ray, who knows his footwork among the federal agencies, was the one who I think was primarily responsible for the fact that we have acquired just double the amount of federal financing for this complex, including the library, as we originally thought possible. Something in excess of $2 million federal funding. He was ably assisted by Mr. Ryberg, who put together the first plan of a new concept of matching grants for libraries that had been set up by the federal government.
but nobody had been able until our proposal went in to put together the complexities of the paperwork in a convincing manner. So the grant for this library was based upon the work of Mr. Ryberg, Dr. Ray, vice presidents of the planning groups of students and faculty I mentioned, and a committee of the Board of Regents, which went through all the pain of negotiating with architects and contractors and consultants and bringing the project to its final development stage. And that planning committee of the Board of Regents must have spent hundreds of hours at, shall I say, no expense to the taxpayer. Spent it willingly, enthusiastically. That was a group headed by the present president of the Board of Regents, who was then the vice president, Mr. William O'Neill. A member of it was Mr. Robert McFarland, who's unable to be here today, but who is now the head of that committee and vice president of the board. The planning work began in 1961. The discussion began in 1960 for this facility. The idea grew out of work of the board that this was an absolute necessity for the future. Therefore, let's get on with the planning. In 64, we had the first statement. We used Mr. Larry Lackey to help us coordinate our planning, our consulting on master planning for the University of San Francisco. And in 1964, it was placed before the legislature in printed form just 10 days before the Good Friday earthquake. So the project was delayed a couple of years, and there was an escalation of costs. And we continued to plan, and we presented it in 1966 to the governor, to the legislature. It was approved, went out to the vote of the people, and I think was carried by something like 4.5-1 in the bond election in November of 1966. And we then began the construction. And we had the earth opened, the old power plant removed, the old warehouses removed. The entire hillside was opened by the Burgess Construction Company carrying out the planning done by architect Mr. Mayor of Anchorage. When the great Fairbanks flood of 1967 came, to almost wipe us out. So we have seen some earth-shaking and earth-inundating events in the course of time which has taken to bring this project to its happy conclusion. For those persons who may be a bit impatient with the manner which things are accomplished in these times, who look for push-button, instantaneous conclusions to whatever it is they may hold at the moment as of pressing importance. I hope that they'll reflect upon the history of this project, which took us a decade to accomplish. And there wasn't a single moment in that period of time which effort was not going forward on the project. But it's been worth every bit of the effort. And we're all proud of it. And I think we are particularly proud of the opportunity to place on the building for all time the name of Elmer E. Rasmussen. Without his courageous and dedicated leadership on this project, no matter how much effort all the rest of us put into it, there would be no building today. one man who made it possible in the final analysis was the man for whom the building, or to whom the building is being dedicated on the third day of May, 1970, which is the historic day in which the territorial legislature of the state of Alaska authorized, if you please, passed the legislation that founded what is now the University of Alaska. So Mr. Rasmussen, I think I can sum up what I wanted to say here in a telegram which comes to me from one of my predecessors in office. Please convey Katrina's and my warmest congratulations to Elmer and Mary Louise Rasmussen on the occasion of dedicating the university libraries, a well-deserved honor for one who through two decades has done so much for the University of Alaska. Signed, former President Terrace Moore. Thank you.
Rasmussen to now unveil the plaque, which will, of course, be placed near the entrance of the main entrance of the library. She's being assisted by Mary Kay Hughes, this year's recipient of the Marion Francis Boswell Memorial Award, which is awarded each year to the senior woman highest in character, personality, activities, and scholarship. So we stand while we... University of Alaska, and it reads Elmer E. Rasmussen Library, named in honor of Elmer E. Rasmussen, pioneer Alaska banker and civic leader, a member of the Board of Regents 1950-1956, and president of the board 1956-1969, whose able leadership contributed immeasurably to the building of a modern university. Dedicated May 3rd, 1970.
Dr. Wood, very distinguished platform participants, Mrs. Bartlett, Mrs. Miller, and all you fine representatives of our university family. I think this day is particularly auspicious because it's the birthday of two people whom I have very close rapport. Dr. Wood, the president of the university, and my sister, Mrs. Atwood, who I understand has made more use of the library already than anyone else in the organization. In the course of the many years that I have been associated with the university, I think I've been at the dedication of just about every building on this campus. And I've felt that every time I've been present, it's been an event of great consecration for a consecration of that particular building for a particular use. And I feel that libraries especially, like churches, have an inspirational quality about them just in their being. Libraries have had a very special attachment to me all my life, and I will be eternally grateful to those dedicated members of the Skagway Women's Club who set up the first library that I had the chance to use. And 2 years ago, when Mary Louise and I were touring the state under the guises of a political campaign, we always used to try to look at the library in that particular community. And some of the finest libraries we have in our state are in very out-of-the-way places. Two particularly come to my mind. One is at Moose Pass on the Kenai Peninsula, and another one is at Cold Bay on the Alaska Peninsula. In each of these instances where we saw fine libraries, they were due to these very dedicated citizenry, usually women, who were responsible for them. Other places that we went to, sometimes there were no books. At other times, even more sadly, the books were shut up at 5 o'clock. And I think that we came away with the conclusion that you can fairly state that the personality of a community is pretty much proportionate to its library. You've heard the little history of the library on this campus. When I first came here, the library was housed over the gymnasium. And many a person has told me that it was a great feat of academic concentration to continue your study when they were practicing basketball down below. And I remember when we moved the library into Bunnell Hall, we all felt that that was a great step forward. Though I knew that this was merely a transitory step until we could bring the library into its own home at last. I want to say now, very simply and most humbly, that there could be no honor I could prize more highly than to have my name associated with the University Library. Now, last Friday, there was a symposium chaired by Dr. Cutler, a very distinguished panel, on the abuses and the uses of libraries. And many of the points that were discussed there had come to my mind in my thinking about the purpose of this library and what it's going to mean to us. And I'm going to share some of these conclusions with you now. First, of course, I think we all agree, as has been said in the platform here, that a library is not a building in itself, and it's certainly not a place to be revered. It's a place where you're going to use the facilities of the library. We all know that it is the very heart of the university. And it's a place to which every student, every faculty member, I hope every citizen of Alaska can come, use it, and study, and perhaps the best use might be in quiet meditation. But I think the important thing that I felt was coming out of this panel discussion, and I believe very strongly, is that there is a kind of a creative throw-off that comes from a library that is greater even than the library perhaps itself. Usually by its very location, which is convenient, by the kind of tranquility of its atmosphere, by the inspirational quality that comes with a library, there is a multiple use of libraries. Many of you know that in Anchorage, the city council meets in the Lusac Library. And I found out that when I was in the city administration, that there was a real demand by people for community facilities that would be involved in a library close to them. They would rather meet in a library than almost any other institution. So I think that it's very fitting that this great library should be associated in the same complex with the humanities and the fine arts. But I think so much of this library that I want to say that if it's to be really a great library, which is what we want, it must be a catalyst for other libraries. Now, obviously, this can be in support of those separate and decentralized libraries that come with departments and different disciplines. And, of course, a logical extension of that is that this library should give support to our community libraries, our community college libraries throughout the state, and also the libraries of our sister educational institutions. I feel also that this library should be the guiding stimulus for community libraries throughout the state. And recently, the Rasmussen Foundation made a experimental grant, hopefully on a matching basis, to stimulate the extension and improvement of library facilities, particularly in rural areas. Finally, I feel that for a library to really soar and have its greatest function, it should excite the desire of every Alaskan to have his own library. And in this connection, I've often quoted from Augustine Birrell in his comments on book buying. Good as it is to inherit a library, it is better to collect one. And libraries are not made, they grow. Now to share in the words of dedication, I would like to repeat the admonition of our Lord. And into whatsoever house ye enter, first say, peace be to this house.
Peace will rest with us, that it will remain in our hearts within this